Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Criminologist David Kennedy has spent 20 years working to solve the puzzle of violence in urban America. He helped create the program Ceasefire, which is credited with reducing youth homicide rates by as much as 66%. That program, nicknamed the Boston Miracle, has now been implemented in more than 70 cities nationwide. The Ceasefire model essentially aims to reduce gang violence by presenting group members with an ultimatum: stop the shooting or we'll target you. He says that model has been remarkably successful because most of the people doing the shooting are the same people who are the targets, and they don't really want to be caught in that cycle either. Kennedy also says that most of what we think we know about crime is wrong. He is the director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control, and he's a professor of criminal justice at John Jay College, and his book is Don't Shoot One Man, A Street Fellowship and the End of Violence in Inner City America. Hi, David.
Morning.
He's joining us from Argo Studios in New York. Also joining us today is Reverend George Cummings, who's the pastor of the Imani Community Church in Oakland. He's a member of the PICO National Network and Lifelines to Healing. And Pastor Cummings is co-chair of the Oakland Ceasefire Community Working Group. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. We're also joined on the line by Kelly McMillan, who's chief of the Salinas Police Department. He came to the department as an officer in 1988 and was appointed chief of police in 2011, and he has implemented the department's ceasefire strategy and is the police department's representative for the California City's Gang Prevention Network. Hi, Kelly. Thank you for joining us, Chief McMillan. All right, so there's so much to wade through here. I want to get to how ceasefire works, but first, I think that there's some really interesting things in your book, David, about the misconceptions that you say that we have about what crime is, who the criminals are, and you write about these kind of myths and stereotypes of three communities dealing with high crime. So I wonder if you could just talk about those misconceptions as you understand them.
Sure. So we believe a lot of things about crime, depending on where we stand. And from the outside, as we look at communities and neighborhoods that seem very, very violent and very dangerous, The main thing that outsiders think is that these are bad places full of bad people, that the guys who are killing each other over apparently nothing at all are sociopaths, and that in the quiet that we often see coming from their own people, that people either like living like this or are complicit or just don't care. The main thing there is we think people involved in this want to be involved in it. And the communities look at the cops and the way the cops behave, and they think the cops like what they're doing. And the most fundamental thing to say about any of this is that that's all wrong. Nearly nobody in these communities acts violently. Those who do are mostly trapped and desperate, not psychopaths. They hate what's going on. They fear and mistrust the outside and have good historical experience that bears that out. But nobody involved in this is having a good time. The guys on the street are not getting rich. Their families are terrified for them. They're terrified for their families. The community wants help. They just don't want the kind of help that we're currently giving them.
And you say that oftentimes law enforcement is creating problems rather than solving them.
Yeah, so let's go back to what you said by way of introduction of Operation Ceasefire, which is that it says to people, you stop what you're doing or we're going to jump on you with both feet. If that were actually how ceasefire worked, I think it's fair to say nobody involved in this phone call would want anything to do with it. That's actually closer to the way law enforcement tends to address these neighborhoods right now. There are a very, very small number of people in the most dangerous places driving things. It ends up being something like 5% of the 18 to 25-year-old young men in the most dangerous neighborhoods. And of that 5%, it's maybe 20% that really make things happen. Ends up literally being a handful of people whose names we know very often on a neighborhood basis. And at its worst, what law enforcement does is move into those neighborhoods, treat everybody like a felon, disrespect everybody, stop everybody over time, arrest nearly everybody. The men go to prison. They can never get a decent job. They're less likely to stay with their families. Their kids are more likely to do badly. Their kids are more likely to fall out of school. At its worst, and this is far too true for far too many of our poor minority neighborhoods across the country, we are destroying the village in order to save it. And then we look at the dysfunction in these neighborhoods and blame the people who live there for it.
And you bring up something that I think few of us actually acknowledge, which is that drug markets don't necessarily create chaos and violence. And you point to the thriving drug markets on most college campuses, many high school campuses, et cetera. And then you write, angry black communities say that there's as much dope in white suburbs as here, but you're only kicking in our doors, only arresting our sons. And in fact, today in the East Bay Express, there's a new report out from Oakland, which shows that almost 90% of the arrests for possession of marijuana are of black and Latino arrestees, which is obviously shocking because I think every study about who uses marijuana shows that a lot of people are using it, and it's certainly not happening only in communities of color. So let me bring you into this, Pastor Cummings. What do you think are the biggest misconceptions that we have about what's causing the violence and how to stop it?
Well, I think that David is correct. And first of all, acknowledging that the communities that where there's a lot of violence are communities that are defined in a particular kind of way. Eugene Robinson, in his book Disintegration, refers to those communities as left-behind communities, who have a sense of hopelessness because they are caught in a cycle of poverty. And because of that, very often people turn to other ways of making a living, and very often that leads for young men to selling drugs on the corner. Drugs bring violence. Violence includes guns. And so there's a connection between the two. So one of the biggest misconceptions that David points to, and I think he's correct, is the general attitude of the media that presents these communities as if everybody in these communities are involved in violence and committed to violence. Because they don't say anything about it in a public way, that means that they support what is going on there, when in fact the majority of the people living in Oakland, for example, do not want violence, want safe communities, and want the shooting to stop. Now, there are a lot of reasons why people don't speak publicly about it, but nevertheless, David is quite correct that in all of our studies and all of our assessments, it's a relatively small group of people, often young men of color, who are involved both in the shooting and who are themselves victims of gun violence in those cities.
Now, David also writes about law enforcement attitudes, which oftentimes replicate those same frustrations and anger. But there's also historical institutionalized racism that needs to be acknowledged and sort of addressed. But one of the things that David really has found in working with law enforcement officials is that these are very well-meaning people who really do care and want to help, but are oftentimes also caught in this cycle of kind of an old way of thinking about this.
In my work with law enforcement in the city of Oakland around ceasefire, I have discovered that that is generally true. One of the reasons that the ceasefire model emphasizes a collaboration between, on the one hand, law enforcement and the community on the other side, is that we acknowledge and hope that the relationship of working together on a common issue will enable us to develop really transformative relationships.
So let's talk about these transformative relationships, because that's really what ceasefire attempts to do. And it's not as easy as David maybe says it is. But so let's talk about, maybe just give us the basics of kind of what the premise of ceasefire is and how it works. And then I'm going to bring Chief McMillan into it and Pastor Cummings to explain how it's worked in Salinas and Oakland specifically. Go ahead, David.
Well, if we start with what we've all just said, the community hates what's going on. The law enforcement community is fundamentally well-intentioned, even if it's not been acting effectively. The street scene that produces the violence is comprised of a very, very small number of people. So what ceasefire does is start with those facts. You can identify those street guys. In particular, you can identify the groups they run in. The violence is rooted in very small numbers of very active groups, gangs, drug crews, sets, whatever you want to call them. It's a group dynamic on the street, which is why a lot of what we traditionally do doesn't work. If you've got two crews beefing, and there's been, you know, recent homicides in both directions, and you send the guys who do those killings to prison, you're left with two groups beefing on the street. You haven't changed anything. So you have to focus on the groups. What ceasefire does is put a partnership together of community figures, social service providers, and law enforcement. And that partnership enters into a direct, sustained relationship with those groups. And essentially what the partnership does is say and keep three promises. It says, we care about you. People in your own community value you enormously. They need you alive, they need you out of prison, and they absolutely, categorically disapprove of a few things you're doing. And you have to stop doing the things that tear your community apart. But if you do that, then we are there for you. The social service providers say, you are going to put your guns down. This is not a negotiation. There is no excuse for it. And we would like to help you. So anybody in your set, reach out to us, and we will turn ourselves inside out to help you change your life. And law enforcement says, believe it or not, we respect you, we care about you, we don't want to lock you up, we especially don't want to bury you and have to go tell your mother that you're dead. This is group stuff, you know it, we know it, and from now on, we are putting you on prior notice that we are following the violence back to the groups. We want you to listen to your own people, we want it to have you take the help that's being offered. But once again, this is not a negotiation. And after this conversation, the next group in the city that kills somebody, everybody in law enforcement will focus everything they've got on that group. We'll go after the shooter for the killing, but it is the nature of these groups that on any given day, nearly everybody in them is committing crimes. And so we will look at any and all crimes, everybody in the set may be committing, and if we can, we will reach out and touch you. We don't want to do it. We just want you to stop, and now you're in charge.
And then sometimes you do go in and actually have to crack down on somebody to show that there is a stick approach in this, what has derisively been called hug a thug, right?
You keep all of your promises, and the community finds its voice, the social service folks do the work that they can do with people who want it. And yes, where there is violence, you act.
And in order for this to work, you have to have buy-in from law enforcement, from community members, people that you call influencers, people like Pastor Cummings. You have to have buy-in from the so-called gang members on the street, the people creating the violence, and community service providers. So Tell us how it's working in Oakland, and then we'll hear about Salinas in just a moment, Chief McMillan.
Well, it's absolutely true, Holly, that you have to have buy-in, and that is a big assumption, and that's a lot of times where the difficulty is. Law enforcement has to be committed to the kind of approach that says, you know, we respect these community, we respect the people in these communities, and we're prepared to work with them, and we're prepared to think about how we do law enforcement differently. And I think on the community side, it means that the community has to think about how they relate to law enforcement. So that's why I call it transformative. Now, in Oakland, we've had over the last 5 months an extraordinary collaboration going on. We've got the affirmation and support of the police department, the mayor, all of the pieces that need to be in place are there to make the ceasefire model go. And we've been working hard at it. Now, there are challenges. Challenges include whether or not it's one thing to have the command structure of the police department be committed to a model of neighborhood policing, but unless you can retrain the whole department all the way down to the line officers, you're not going to have that kind of compliance. You're still going to have incidents that create suspicion and anger in the community, and then the community begins
things
to wonder.
Things like stop and frisk? I mean, is that what you mean?
Things like stop and frisk.
So this sense of, because I'm a young black man, I'm just going to get stopped by the police no matter what I do.
That's right. And so in our ceasefire core team meeting, we've had long conversations about both the gang injunction and stop and frisk, and police chief Jordan has gone on record saying that he is not going to implement that in Oakland because he understands that it sometimes targets young men who are not themselves involved in that kind of activity, the kind of violent activity and criminal activity that we're focusing on.
And let me pull Kelly McMillan into this, chief of the Salinas Police Department. You're in David Kennedy's book, and you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about the ceasefire model of violence prevention. And David Kennedy, his book is called Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship and the End of Violence in Inner City America. We're also speaking with the Reverend George Cummings, who's pastor of the Imani Community Church in Oakland, and he's co-chair of the Oakland Ceasefire Community Working Group. And Kelly McMillan, you're in David's book because you called him up and said, hey, can you guys come and do ceasefire here? So tell us how that worked and what's happening in Salinas now.
Well, it was a fascinating process early on. 2009 was the most violent year that we've ever seen in Salinas. We had 29 homicides in the city, and we're a city of 150,000 people, relatively small community. 29 homicides, unique about that was 100% of them were gang-related. So if you look at it in the alternative, if you could eliminate gang violence, you've got 150,000 people in a community where there's no homicide, which is pretty remarkable. And so with this huge gang violence problem, we reached out and fortunately got some grant money and were able to implement ceasefire in 2010. And so I'd like to comment real quickly on you know, that two-pronged approach of enforcement that's directed towards the most violent and then supporting those who are willing to step away. It turns out that turning the ship around in terms of law enforcement attitude, and both David and Brevin Cummings have commented on this, is really very difficult to do. You know, there's a long tradition of law enforcement, particularly gang enforcement kinds of units, whose modus operandi was to you know, drive the streets of the community looking for gang members who are out doing whatever gang members may be doing, and you know, kind of approaching them with a zero tolerance approach. And as our guests have pointed out, that creates distrust when you're grabbing a kid who may look like a gang member in an area where we know gang members hang out, but turns out he's just a junior college student driving home from class. But he gets treated like a gang member. And so one of the first things we had to do in Salinas was start to change the way we approached violence. And the way we did that was by taking our gang units and changing their mission from street enforcement to data-driven, strategic, and targeted enforcement towards those that we knew were driving the violence in Salinas. And, you know, as David said, there really aren't that many people who are willing to pick up a gun and use it. There may be a lot of gang members, but the reality is, and people oftentimes don't believe it, the reality is most gang members are gang members because that's how they've grown up in neighborhoods where there are lots of gang members. And so their association, their friendships are based in those relationships. It doesn't mean that they're out shooting people. And so when we started targeting those people and started seeing the violence reductions and started seeing trust being slowly rebuilt in the community, we knew we were onto something. And then the other part was when that violence did break out, we were very targeted in how we went about addressing those who we believe to be involved and their associates to reinforce that message that violence wouldn't be tolerated. So it was a huge shift really in law enforcement thinking and the way we were approaching it, and then developing those community relationships that really allowed us to see what our traditional approach was doing in the community.
And so has it transformed the way that your department approaches law enforcement?
It really has, particularly around youth violence. Our, like I mentioned, our gang units, and there are two of them that function primarily in the city of Salinas, don't do a lot of general street enforcement just because it's relatively ineffective and does cause that kind of community harm. They are very targeted in their mission in terms of identifying those who are doing the violence. And a lot of people think that means going after the leadership. Well, it may not always be the case. Many times the leadership are directing youngsters to go out and do the violence. And so we'll go after those youngsters if they're the ones who are willing to pick up the gun. But it's a matter of identifying very specifically who's at the root of the violence and targeting them. The community understands that that's a legitimate law enforcement mission, and as long as law enforcement is acting in their neighborhoods legitimately, they will understand, accept, and support that kind of enforcement.
What was the process like to get community buy-in around these ideas?
Well, when we were developing our strategy, we called in members of the community and, you know, the providers and nonprofits that worked directly with those community members, heard from them what they expected of law enforcement, and it was really kind of what this conversation we've been having is, which is, you know, find the right people and deal with them. Don't paint us all that broad brush of we're all gang members because we happen to live here. And then engaging those partners in the call-ins where we brought in members of these violent groups, sat them down and said, as David was saying, we value you and care about you, and you've got to stop. We'll help you stop, and if you don't, we'll make you stop.
And Reverend Cummings, you've said that we kind of need to rethink this term gang and the way that has us frame kind of this oppositional way of looking at each other.
Yes, I think David in his book refers to groups, and I think that's important because sometimes the people we're talking about don't necessarily see themselves as gangs. And so whether they're crews, sets, gang, whatever they are, there are associations of people who very often are the drivers of violence in the community. The ceasefire model is a data-driven model, and so it means we look carefully at where the activity is occurring and who is driving it, and then target those people in order to try to transform the conversation. And the community is critical to the conversation because very often the people who are involved in the activity are connected to other people in the community who are very concerned about their safety and who want them to stay alive and free, not to go to jail. And so a critical part of the message, the common message that we communicate is, look, you're a part of the community, you're a part of our family, we care about you, and we want you to stay alive and free.
And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. You just heard from the Reverend George Cummings, who's pastor of the Imani Community Church in Oakland. He's a member of the PICO National Network and Lifelines to Healing, and he's co-chair of the Ceasefire Working Group in Oakland. We're also joined on the line by Chief Kelly McMillan, who is chief of police in Salinas, California, where they've also implemented Ceasefire, and he says that it's working there. And we're talking with David Kennedy, who's director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control. He's a professor of criminal justice at John Jay College, and he's been studying the roots of violence for 20 years, and he's written a book, Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. He says that ceasefire is a piece of the solution to the violence that's plaguing some of our neighborhoods. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after a short break.
Listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find links related to today's program. It's also where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. Just click the email newsletter link on the right side of the page at yourcallradio.org. Thank you.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also find out there what's coming up on the show. Tomorrow, we'll be doing deep sea diving to find out how human technology is affecting underwater life. For example, how sonar is affecting dolphins. Friday is our weekly media roundtable, and we'll speak with journalists about the week's news and coverage. Today, we're talking about the best way to deal with crime and violence in our cities. We're talking with David Kennedy, who's the author of Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. He piloted the ceasefire program in Boston, which drastically reduced homicide rates, and it's being implemented in places like Salinas and Oakland now. So how is it working, and what do you think are the long-term solutions to ending violence in urban America? You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255, or you can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you've heard about ceasefire, what do you want to understand about how it actually works? And how do you define crime and something like gangs? And what if you're wrong about that? What do you think is the solution to end the shooting in Salinas? And do we need to rethink our criminal justice system? The number to join our conversation is 866-798-8255. And if you're somebody who's been involved in what we're calling a gang, we'd like to hear from you about your perspective. Or if you're a young man in one of these neighborhoods that's especially violent, what's been your experience? And we'd like to have you engage in this dialogue with law enforcement and community members. 866-798-8255. And I want to bring up something that's in the book and is very much a big piece of this and is not necessarily widely acknowledged in our society, and that is the phenomenon of mass incarceration and the fact that we have had a prison explosion over the last 30 years, and it's primarily affected, it's decimated the black communities in urban America, and it's primarily locking up young black and Latino men and now women. So let's talk a little bit about this. What are some of the realities that may maybe are not fully understood?
Well, Holly, once we began to look in Oakland at what are the fundamental causes of violence and who are the perpetrators, I mean, literally we discovered that in the areas of Oakland where there was high incidences of violence, there were large numbers of formerly incarcerated people. And we began to realize that there was a connection between the violence, the gun violence that was going on in Oakland, and people who were coming back from prison. So then we began to take a look more carefully at the whole question of mass incarceration and how it then affects the community. And one of my friends, Dr. Marshall, speaks about what he calls the AC world and the BC world. 1980, he calls it, he says, before crack and after crack. That crack and the three strikes you're out law in the state of California led to a stream of mass incarceration for particularly young men of color who ended up in prison and then who inevitably come back to the community, scarred from that experience and unable to find work, turn to drugs or turn to gangs as a means of survival, and that includes violence, and that often leads to the kind of gun violence that we see in our community. So mass incarceration is a critical question that must be addressed if we are going to address the long-term issue of violence in our communities.
And David, you write about this, and you write about if we really wanted to sort of crack down on drugs, we'd be kicking in doors of white college students, for example. You go on to write, the point is that no community can survive many, most, or all of its men having criminal records, surging back and forth between prison and home, damaged for life, no matter what they want and what they do. Do you want to talk about that for a minute before we go to our calls, David?
Yeah, I do. We have a long history of thinking about the root causes of violence. It's an honorable way of trying to do this work. And the root causes we turn to are racism and lack of economic opportunity and bad schools and inadequate family support and a long, long list of insults to troubled neighborhoods. One of the greatest insults to troubled neighborhoods is locking up all the men so that they are, as Pastor Cummings said, irretrievably damaged no matter what they do. One of my black friends said, if you want to destroy a civilization, lock it up. And that is correct. The tragedy here is that the cops doing this work and putting all of these mostly young men into the pipeline are doing it because they want to protect the community. And they are going to the places where there is fear and violence, which is exactly what they ought to be doing. And they are doing law enforcement work, which is exactly what they ought to be doing. And with the best of intentions, are doing enormous damage. What we need is that focus in those places with a different approach and different outcomes. And what we're learning one can do is, rather than carpet bombing the neighborhood, you can identify, and we keep saying this, all of us keep saying it, the very few people who are driving the violence and driving the rest of that cycle. And you don't necessarily even have to lock them up. You can sit down with them. You can talk to them. You can talk to their mothers. You can tell them exactly what the future holds for them. And once things get that particular, these guys are not stupid. They don't play in traffic. And when we are that clear and that consistent and that transparent, they will pay attention and they will respect us.
And yet at our kind of national level of dialogue, for the most part, it's really about sort of lock them up, public safety. Chief McMillan, you said that the fact that so many of us do not have to live with these unacceptable levels of violence, that we don't see this as a public emergency, it's those people over there that this is happening to and who are doing that. So how do you get the larger society to care and to stop looking at it as just, okay, we'll just lock everybody up and everything will be fine?
Well, I'll tell you, that's one of my ongoing frustrations is in speaking to the broader community, you know, who really doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about this, whose attitude is, why don't you just, you know, commonly just throw them all in, you know, the Oakland Coliseum, let them shoot it out, and that'll be the end of the problem because nobody cares about those folks. You battle that sort of red meat perception that if you just lock people up, that'll fix the problem, when I think there's just overwhelming evidence in California particularly that our prison system doesn't fix a thing. One of the challenges I'd like to add here, you know, that we face is so true that even the hardest of the hardcore of our gang members don't want to be in this lifestyle. They truly don't. And if you have an honest conversation with them, they'll reveal that. The other side of it is the opportunity and the resources that have to be rained down on someone who is so indoctrinated into that lifestyle are so intensive that the need just outweighs our ability to provide what we know will work. And that really is what's making, particularly in California, where we have so few police officers relative to you know, the rest of the country, making the strategy effective broadly.
And locking people up will not work as long as you're just warehousing them and not providing rehabilitation services that will enable them, once they have reentered the population, to become productive citizens. And so I've become personally convinced that unless we begin to deploy the kind of resources in prison, rehabilitation resources, not just during the last few months of their incarceration, but from the time they enter prison, you have to begin to think about reentry. And because the fact of the matter is that people who we lock up will come back to the community, and we want them to come back to the community as whole and healthy contributors to the society. And so locking people up is simply not going to be to solve the problem in the long run.
And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about ceasefire and how to solve the problems of violence and crime in inner city America. So let's go to some of our calls. Let's go first to Zachariah in Berkeley. Hi, Zachariah. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Listen, besides love, what does everybody want in this world? Money. That's why these young men are out there hustling for money. It's the drug trade. I've I worked as a substitute teacher in Oakland. I know the streets of Oakland. We have to address drugs in this country. We have to legalize it in some way to take all the profit out of the drug trade. If we do that, these young men won't get arrested. They won't get sent to prison in the first place.
Zachariah, stay on the line, because this brings up a lot of issues, the economic issue, the issue of how to support these young men in transitioning out of that. And David writes a lot about the drug trade in his book. So, David, why don't you first respond? Can I just say something about your book that I thought was really interesting, which you point out that a lot of the people who are selling drugs are essentially making minimum wage, still living at home with their moms. This is not a lucrative business for most of the folks on the streets. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So what Zachariah just said is something that makes...
Did we lose David? Somehow we just lost David. Go ahead and respond to Zachariah, and then we'll get into the part of ceasefire, which is about trying to help find jobs for folks.
Sure. I think, Zachariah, you're absolutely correct. There are a number of ways in which we need to address the issue of drugs. People are indeed entering into drug market in neighborhoods that are dispossessed because they're trying to make a living. They're trying to pay, take care of their children and take care of their families and take care of themselves. And very often that is what drives them back oft when they come back from prison, when they're unable to find jobs. So one of the key components of the ceasefire model is the social services model, where we provide opportunities for young men who are interested in getting out of that life to begin to get job training and begin to move into a different direction.
Well, and I wonder how well that part of it is working, because I know that it's, you know, we're in a tremendous recession. The black community in parts of Oakland have been in a depression for decades, frankly. But so how is that part working? Are there enough jobs for folks?
Well, it's hard work on two levels. Number one, very often the young men you are talking about have to be retrained. If you've been multi-generationally involved in gangs and poverty and have not worked ever in your life, just getting you a job is not going to be the answer. You have to help people to learn how to be employed, how to continue to sustain themselves in this new way. And then secondly, of course, you've got to have jobs. And the fact of the matter is, in Oakland and in many other urban settings, as long as you have a shrinking tax base and the manufacturing industry leaving, simply finding jobs and employment is a difficult thing to do. So we have a lot of challenges. And a big part of those challenges has to do with trying to work with corporations and other companies and Walmart and other kinds of retailers to bring industry back into the city so that people will at least be able to have a job that provides them with a living wage.
Holly,
David,
can I add on to that?
Yeah.
You know, coming back to this whole idea, and the Reverend's exactly right, that it's not, you can't just offer a guy who's been in the prison system his entire life a job, you know, driving a forklift at a cooler on the night shift. It's just not going to work that easily. When we rolled out the strategy here in Salinas, we brought our employers together, and Salinas is an agricultural-based economy, fresh produce primarily. So we brought a lot of those big employers together and said, here's what we need is opportunity for these young men, some mentoring. And they were very willing to help us. But what we didn't anticipate, didn't see coming, was the tremendous public backlash that we got from people saying, now, wait a minute, you know, my kid just graduated from college and can't get a job, yet you're trying to find opportunity for these criminals. How dare you? How can you do that? You're going to bring these dangerous men into the workplace and create a dangerous situation for the good people, which are understandable concerns, not really based in reality, but it does point to how difficult it is, first in implementation and then more broadly in the public perception and understanding realm to get this work done.
So how did you resolve that? How did you talk to people about this?
Well, honestly, we publicly we stopped talking about who was going to provide opportunity, who was willing to help us. So we maintain those partnerships with people who are willing to offer opportunity to these folks, because you can't just give them the job. They have to be closely supervised, monitored, and mentored. But we don't talk about that publicly anymore because that backlash still remains.
So I wonder this with all of you, isn't that part of the problem, that we're not acknowledging the reality of some of these situations, that we're really allowing ourselves to continue to work from this place of total fear and otherness? That these guys are criminals, they're absolutely irredeemable, they should be locked out of society, and this hug-a-thug stuff is just nonsense.
No, I think that's absolutely right, Holly. I think that to the extent that... So one of the reasons I think education is really important. So we have been in Oakland working through various clergy groups and to engage stakeholders, not just faith community, but other nonprofits, in a conversation about long-term solutions. And that means acknowledging that, first of all, we have not provided the kinds of resources that are needed to provide education, because my own belief is that a good education is probably, in the long term, the best solution to gun violence in our community. If we can provide adequate education from the cradle on up, I think we can have a better chance to get people into the game called America, number one. Number two, it seems to me that until we can begin to get people to begin to think of other members of the society as human beings, so the community has to begin to think about police officers as human beings. Police officers are human beings. They want to go home. They want their neighborhoods to be safe. They want to go home at night. They get scared when they go through neighborhoods where there's a lot of violence. And they're human beings, and we in the community need to look at them. But we also need to look at these young men who very often, many of us in the mainstream, as soon as we see them, pants hanging down with some dreadlocks, we think they're gangbangers, when that is not necessarily the case. And we need to begin to think of young men as a valuable resource. They may be selling drugs on the street, but that means to me that they have entrepreneurial skills that we can turn around and use. They know how to count. That's why they're out there working with money. And I think we need to begin to see each other as in a different light, as human beings. And once we do that, then we can begin to work together.
And let's go to more calls. Margarita in Salinas, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. No, I definitely agree about humanizing the people in the neighborhood. I'm actually from Salinas, and I grew up mainly on the east side of Salinas, which is a part of Salinas that there's more concentration of poverty and crime going on in that area. And I wanted to address the fact that I worked with youth for a number of years. I worked with youth in juvenile hall, volunteering. I worked with youth through school systems. And I wanted to address the fact that I've seen it most commonly used, the gang contract with youth, and how that's definitely affecting future chances for these youth to change their lives. Kids that have hung out with people that are involved in gangs, or maybe have gotten in trouble with the law, or maybe even have family members that are involved in gangs and known within the system, how it quicks to put them on a gang contract. And so I wanted to address that.
Did you want to hear from Chief McMillan?
Sure.
So those gang contracts are pretty effective in schools and in the institutions, particularly post-release. We're dealing with, you know, the younger offenders, where they agree to a set of rules, and that but they only work so long as the supports to allow them to work are in place. And again, this comes back to the resource question, that there are so many young men in need and so few resources to support them that it becomes a challenge, you know, on a broad basis to really make sure that those that those supports are there. I will tell you that one of the things, you know, this question of employment is really critical. It's really important, but it's not the only thing that works. One of the things that we've learned, and particularly with the California ceasefire sites where, you know, the jobs simply aren't there, one of the things that we understand now works in an honest conversation with these folks is simply describing the harm they're doing to the communities, with what David would describe as the moral voice of the community, and letting them know, you know, as a police officer, I can say, you shouldn't shoot people because you'll get sent to prison. Well, that really doesn't bother a lot of these guys because they already believe that that's their destiny. But when we sit down with members of the community and say, if you shoot somebody, that affects your mother and your sister and your neighbors and the people around you that care for you, you're really hurting the people you know and love, that and that alone can start to change behavior. And so the message that we're delivering to these young men is beginning to change.
And, you know, we've been talking about the economics of this, the fact that we don't have resources to necessarily have these support services that might get people out of the drug trade, and yet it costs something like $40,000 to $50,000 a year to lock somebody up in our prison system. So I think we've got to talk about these things together. Let's go to a couple more callers. Let me have these guys come on back to back, and then we'll get some response from our panel. Rita in Berkeley, welcome to your call.
Thank you. I've spent a lifetime practicing medicine, taking care of people who are involved with heroin in that area geographically. And I wrote an opinion piece in the Oakland Tribune in the mid-80s predicting what's happening now. And I feel like the speakers have been very articulate, and I would invite them to look at the Portuguese experiment where they came up with a legalization scheme, and it's been in operation now for more than 10 years. And so the results are published, and you can access them, I think, on the Internet. But the summary is all the change that happened was two-thirds of the inmates of prisons were no longer incarcerated. And that's the only real change that you can detect. No increase in use that was possible to measure. So there's a correspondence between the drug war and the instability in the society and people standing in line to get their chance to hold the bag. So even if you have a transitional thing that takes people out, all it's going to do is change the players. But the lure will always be there so long as people are seeking intoxicants to alter their mood.
Okay, Rita, we're running out of time, so I'm going to try and get a response. I want to read an email from Carolyn who says, I think the problem of police being predominantly white and the people they police being predominantly of color creates a situation where sometimes the police may honestly be having a hard time distinguishing between people. It's not an excuse, but it may be a problem. It's understandable that a form of real resentment grows and feeds upon itself. So we just have a couple of minutes left. I'd like to get some final thoughts, what you'd like people to be thinking about differently when we look at crime and violence and how to solve it. Let's start with you, David, and then go to Chief McMillan, and then you'll get the final word, Pastor.
Sure. So we've gone about this in the way that we often do, which is to stack up all of the impediments, all of the problems, all of the, you know, blue sky alternatives that stand in the way of actually getting work done. And what I'd like to point out is that in spite of all of those impediments, people get this. People in law enforcement know that what they've been doing isn't working. They've come to realize that they're doing unintentional harm out there. The communities hate what's going on. And the demand for what we're talking about is growing and outstrips, in fact, our ability to deliver it. So the actual work on the ground with Oakland Ceasefire and in Salinas and now in Sacramento and Stockton and Oxnard and Bakersfield and a number of sites around California that are doing this kind of sort of new frame work is actually being done by my colleague Stuart Wakeling and his colleagues out of the California Partnership for Safe Communities. And he's having the same experience the rest of us who do this are. We can't we can't answer our phone. The cities that want to do this are so many. And despite the attitudinal issues and the resource issues, this stuff is growing, it is happening, and we don't see that slacking off.
Dave, go ahead, Chief McMillan, you just have like 30 seconds if you could give us final thoughts. Sorry about this.
No, quite all right. I'm thankful for the opportunity because I think it's information like this that will make the public start to understand exactly how intractable and wicked this problem is and how it really is everyone's responsibility. This is absolutely not a law enforcement problem, but it can be addressed when law enforcement comes together with the faith community, the nonprofits, the community members who are simply living in those blighted neighborhoods, and together we actually can address this problem. It's a question of commitment and resources.
I recently talked with a 22-year-old young man who had been shot about 8 times and been in juvenile hall and in prison at 22 years old. He said to me, Reverend, I would like to change my life. I cannot continue to live a life where I have to carry a gun and be shot all the time. He wants to change. And I think a lot of the young men in our community want to change, too.
And we'll give you the last word. We've barely scratched the surface with this discussion, but thank you all for joining us. Reverend George Cummings is pastor of the Imani Community Church in Oakland. He's co-chair of the Oakland Ceasefire Community Working Group. We were also joined by Police Chief Kelly McMillan of Salinas, California, and David Kennedy, who's the author of Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. It's all about the ceasefire model. We'll put a link to all of that information at our website. It's yourcallradio.org. You can also continue to post comments there and brainstorm solutions. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How is the U.S. Navy's underwater sonar program affecting underwater life? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about how sonar impacts the marine ecosystem. The Navy uses sonar to scan for surrounding submarines. But advocates of marine life, especially whales and dolphins, say sonar is causing widespread and irreparable damage. They say alternative technologies like satellites could be used to replace sonar. So what's really happening in the ocean? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.